Thank you very much for this wonderful introduction. Actually, I'm supposed to speak about Donald Trump in 2 weeks in München about democratization and democracy in the current world, but today the topic is different. And I hope I may have a chance to talk about my ideas about democratization in our current world. It is a great pleasure to be able to present my idea in front of my beloved colleagues and friends. Many of you have become my really good friends during my stay here. Also, especially, it is my great pleasure to be able to present some of my ideas in front of two directors to whom I'm really grateful for all the help I received during my stay here. I'm today extraordinarily concerned because, on one hand, the topic I want to speak about today is very specifically medievalistic. That is, it is a topic that may interest a very small circle of a medievalist. On the other hand, as I see, you know, as many of my previous speakers must have recognized, many of the present audience are sinologists, so very few chances to get to know about medievalist topics. As my sole wish is not to bring the help of you to sleep after my presentation. I have prepared around 15 pages of text. I read the text directly, and in case you have any problems following me, please let me know, then I will try to improve. When you have still problems, then please give me the second sign. I will try to improve again. But when you have the problems still, then please give up. That is my limitation problem today. Okay, medieval political thought and the art of mastering the human world uncertainty. We are aware that we will face and have to solve some problems in the process of pursuing a project. Unless properly controlled, they may significantly limit the realization of our plan. Those who wish to create, preserve, and reform the society of human beings, say politicians and political thinkers, cannot but be therefore gravely concerned about such uncertainty. There are numerous causes of uncertainty outside there. Drought, earthquake, flood, global warming, war, civil strife, economic recession, all these natural or man-made problems immediately come to our mind. But we have to confess that we do not have a complete list of them. Some are only potentially there, and they may come into our sight only later, probably as a sudden surprise. Some are already known, but we cannot chart the trajectory of its future development with certainty. The uncertainty of the world is thus partly an epistemological problem. That is, it is related to the problem of our limited ability of diagnosis and prognosis. The developments of analytical tools like new conceptual frameworks or technological infrastructure like supercomputers may help us understand the hitherto unclarified problem and the enormous change of a perception of the uncertainty of the world. Of course, the development of such apparatus tools can eventually introduce a new kind of uncertainty as apocalyptic scientific fiction loves to depict. The problem of uncertainty becomes radicalized when we recognize that such limitation imposed on our knowledge, our power of analysis and prognosis is existential, that is, can never be fundamentally removed from our human conditions. Such a radicalized conception of uncertainty then triggers a significant philosophical deliberation. How to live with such an uncertainty? This question preoccupied the preeminent minds of the West, mixed with a series of feelings, uneasiness, resignation, and frustration, etc. We have rich textual evidence of such deliberations on the uncertainty of the human world. Plato's attempt to characterize political knowledge, episteme politica, in his dialogues is a classical example. He distinguished political knowledge from philosophical insight, which focuses on the unchanging and universal, and can be known through syllogical procedure. Even he tried to specify an area of our human soul that is responsible for that mental action in political reasoning. For him, there is no infallible knowledge about administrating human community. He was followed by his pupil Aristotle, who argued in Politics and Nicomachean Ethics that, on account of unlimited varieties of the form of human life and its development, a universal knowledge of politics is not possible. All knowledge of politics is only approximate knowledge. Exactly for this reason, he believed the study of politics is inappropriate for young people who indeed may be good at logical thinking, but do not have enough experiences of life that will complement it. The deliberation of uncertainty of the human world is especially important for understanding the pathos and the ethos of modern political thought. It may be said in a sense that the modern political discourse began with two remarks on the uncertainty of the human world. Around 6 years before he was driven out of his office by the restored Medici regime in 1512, Niccolò Machiavelli wrote in his private letter to Giovan Battista Soderini as follows. I see that steering along a variety of routes can bring about the same thing, and that acting in different ways can bring about the same end. We have seen and continue to see that kingdoms are conquered or are subdued or have fallen as unforeseen events would have it. Sometimes the way of doing things that was praised when it led to conquest is vilified when it led to defeat. And sometimes when defeat comes after long prosperity, people do not blame anything of their own, but rather indict heaven and the will of the fates. But the reason why different actions are sometimes equally useful and sometimes equally detrimental, I do not know, yet I should like to know. Martin Luther wrote around 1.5 decades later as follows, discussing a right way of judging and deciding by a prince. No matter how good and equitable the laws are, they all make exceptions of cases of necessity in which they cannot be enforced. Therefore, a prince must have the law in hand as firmly as the sword and decide in his own mind when and where the law must be applied strictly or with moderation, so that reason may always control all law and be the highest law and rule over all laws. If a prince feels not competent for such autonomous reasoning, however, he should pray God for it. Luther recommends the example of Solomon saying, despair of law, even of that which Moses, through God, had prescribed for him, and of all princes and counselors, he turned to God himself, prayed to him for a wise heart to rule the people. A prince must follow this example. He must depend neither upon dead book nor upon living heads, but cling solely to God, pray without ceasing to him, and ask for a right understanding above all books and masters wisely to rule his subjects. What combines these thinkers, who otherwise do not share very much in common and have hardly ever been put in discussion in parallel by scholars, is an acute sense of uncertainty pervading the human world and knowledge. For Machiavelli, a course of human affairs is determined by numerous acts and events and their contingent interactions. which human intelligence can neither fully grasp nor control. He does not believe that political reality can be properly described and administered by a consistent set of prescriptions. The whole business of maintaining, preserving the state is thus compared in his prince to a very dangerous confrontation with Fortuna, an ancient goddess of luck and accident. For him, Fortuna is a capricious female and raging river, and only the highest grade of astuteness can save a monarchy or a republic from her malice. At the end of his discussion in the prince, he finally acknowledges that there is no general rule for winning over fortune. One has to learn to adapt to the changes of a fortuna, that is, one has to adopt appropriate strategies of action at the moment under given circumstances, a skill which cannot be taught because it cannot be summarized in a corpus of consistent rules and principles. Machiavelli's notorious political realism originated from this frustration at the impossibility of controlling circumstances by way of given religious and ethical principles. If the term secularization of political discourse and culture signifies a process where people no longer take it for granted to seek for justification of a political decision and action outside individuals in their society, and the concomitant decline and disappearance of religious prescription, metaphysical principles, and other transcendental norms in the deliberation of political affairs, his idea surely stands for this transformation process. If so, Martin Luther is no less responsible for the secularization of political views and ideas. For Luther, the human world is such an enigma and a riddle that even the Decalogue, the prescriptions of the Bible revealed by God via Moses to his people, cannot be an ultimate salvation. A good prince must be of such an unusual mental genius as to follow all those necessities and numerous exceptions. If he does not possess such power, he has to ask to God for it. Thus, his prince is required to proceed, relying on only his own intelligence, attributing to no absolute authority to what the Bible and the other authorities teach. Of course, the two thinkers had different goals in view. Machiavelli was primarily concerned with preservation and aggrandizement of the power of a political community, but Luther would have asked about its service to the true religion. This difference is indeed important, but cannot hide and qualify the significant convergence between them, namely, the world is characterized by radical uncertainties, and politics has become predominantly a matter of independent human reasoning and astuteness. Since the 19th century, researchers have integrated the story of Machiavelli in the narratives of the triumph of rationalism and empiricism over the embargo imposed on human reason by the rule of the religion. It has been repeatedly argued that the flourishing commercialism and incessant power struggles among small states in Italy since the 13th century created a unique constellation where a realistic mentality and culture could grow. It has been argued by a generation of eminent philosophers and historians from Jacob Burckhardt over Wilhelm Dilthey, Leonard Olszewski, Ernst Cassirer, to Friedrich Meinecke, and the political scientist of our time, Helfried Münkler, that with his cold interest, calculation, and bold cynicism, Machiavelli achieved what Copernicus, Leonardo da Vinci, and Galileo Galilei accomplished in the natural science. An erstwhile villain and a devil's advocate has thus become enshrined in the pantheon of great thinkers. Machiavelli's confession of a frustration at the metamorphosis of developments in the human world demonstrates what this convergence has not properly noticed. For all his attempt to find out a general logic which decides on success and failure in human enterprises, he was not sure that there would suddenly be such a logic. In this, he was put in a situation that is fundamentally different from that of the founding fathers of modern natural science, who began with an optimistic assumption that the object of their analysis, the natural universe, is governed by logic and may be controlled by grasping that logic. Given Luther's comparable conception of radical uncertainty of the human world, the old wisdom of the secularization process of political discourse and culture needs an additional revision. The fundamental change of worldview had been taking place all around Europe, not confined to Italian peninsula. The socio-political changes, constellations like the rise of commercialism, capitalism, or bloody wars and power struggles among small states in the Italian peninsula cannot account for the changes of a pan-European scale. Relatively recently, several philosophers and historians like Hans Blumenberg and Heiko Augustinus Obermann have proposed an alternative approach to the secularization of worldview, focusing on the theological absolutism in the nominalist theology elaborated by William Ockham and successive generations of nominalist theologians, which according to them influenced several humanists and Luther. This attempt has merit that it enables us to view secularization in a broad West European context. This interpretation of Ockham's and other nominalist theological view put aside, however, this view seems to be equally partial and problematic because it is not very convincing to make one ideational movement or trend mainly responsible for an ideological cultural change that swept the whole Western Europe. The attempt to trace the lineage of a nominalist theory of the world leading to Italian Renaissance humanism has hardly gone past the preliminary hypothesis. I believe that the attempt to find the origin of a changing worldview in the revival of ancient knowledge by humanism has the same problem. Today, I will endeavor to present an alternative hypothesis. I will pursue the transformation of the conception of political order in the political literature of the Middle Ages, focusing on the radical paradigm change which took place since the early 14th century. I will highlight a radical change of the view on politics and the world, which the power struggles of different political actors since the 14th century brought about. I will show how this change anticipates the secularization of political discourse of the later ages, which we primarily observed in Machiavelli and Luther. In the first place, I will discuss the optimistic rationalist conception of the human world that characterized the political discourse of the early and high Middle Ages. In the second part, I will try to pursue the recess of this view and the emergence of a new conception, which is based on an acute consciousness of radical uncertainty which fills the human world, while discussing four representative thinkers, John of Paris, Ptolemy of Lucca, Marsilius of Padua, and Bartolus of Sassoferrato. An important conceptual innovation and contribution made during the Middle Ages is the emergence of the notion of a cyclum, or the secular age. In the context of a Christian conception of history, the current world was thought to be a temporary station on the way to eternal salvation, where the final truth will be revealed with the emergence of the heavenly kingdom. Everything existing until then is only temporary and ephemeral. No human institution, no power, no human knowledge can claim its perennial value. It was primarily Augustine who made this concept a central concern of political deliberation during the Middle Ages. In his attempt to save the Christian religion from its slanderers and critics, this eminent bishop of a North African city, Hippo, developed a notion of the function and limitation of the state that massively influenced later discussion on politics. At this time, the Western Empire was declining, and especially the plunder of Rome by the Visigoths, 410, inflamed severe objection to the Christian religion, which had remained the official religion of the empire since 380. Many asked how to understand the humiliation troubles afflicting a Christian state. Augustine's argumentative strategy to save the Christian religion from this ignominy involved denying that the Roman Empire was a truly Christian state protected by God's special grace, an idea which was propagated by the imperial throne. Augustine rejected such a sublimation of the secular state. According to him, salvation can be only given by God, whose providence cannot be fully grasped by human intelligence. Equally, salvation cannot be effected by a certain human decision and action. Even a confession to the Christian religion and making it the sole object of official worship. Augustine took the grave effects of the fall on humanity more seriously than any other Christian thinkers before and after him. One of the effects is epistemological, both in his writing on Christian learning and both in his writing on Christian learning and in his polemical works on human free will and divine grace. Augustine stressed that human beings in the post-lapsarian period were significantly limited in their ability to recognize the right way to live in. In his De Doctrina Christiana, the Christian doctrine, he indicates the limitation imposed on our intellect by the fall, citing from the second epistle to the Corinthians, "We work by faith, not by sight." The moral perversion, another and no less significant effect of the fall, is also closely related to epistemological perversion. The fall deprived human beings of the ability to recognize the right way of life and behavior, as well as the willpower to implement it, leaving them vulnerable to evil influences. Augustine radicalized this idea of the effects of the fall into absolutizing God's grace for salvation. In his writing on grace, he even argued that the prescription of the Decalogue could not provide a firm ground and guideline for a virtuous life that will promote the chance for salvation. All these arguments amount to a conclusion that confession to the Christian faith and practices of its religious rituals alone do not make a state divine, which implies that the Romans, even if their empires worship the Christian religion, cannot claim God's special protection and should not blame God for their sufferings. The stress of absolutist character of God's government of the world not only implied a desacralization of the political power, it also introduced a new hermeneutical dimension into political ideas. His idea that no earthly power can fully understand justice to pursue and realize in its real realm contains a paradox, namely, the power holders sometimes must simply accept and follow what is given to them without asking why. This opened the space for a hermeneutical power of the Roman Church that insisted on a monopoly of God's providence during the Middle Ages. A conception and image of the secular world, or cyclum, both as a space and as a period, where human beings are helplessly delivered to a serious event, the logic of which can never be fully opened to the human beings, thus appears as a central question in the political thought of the Middle Ages. With this, a question of political wisdom became acute. What is an appropriate political wisdom? How can such wisdom be acquired? Nevertheless, we should not fall into an oversimplification that the Middle Ages was simply a continuation of such skepticism on human reason that Augustine originated, promulgated in the manner of a professor of political thought, especially in the university in the USA, who begins the part of his lecture on the Middle Ages with Augustine, then springs immediately over one millennium to Machiavelli by way of Thomas Aquinas. It is important to note this fundamental limitation imposed on our knowledge and consequently on our possibility of rational reasoning and action did not paralyze immediately the efforts to regulate the socio-political concerns and the event rationally during the Middle Ages. An Augustinian conception of the human world was widely accepted and shaped the cognitive framework regarding numerous risks and challenges filling it, but it depended on individual thinkers how those ideas were understood and used. When I cite a passage from Libri Carolini, a book written under the auspices of Charles the Great around 792, I intend to demonstrate that the medieval thinkers were quite optimistic about the possibility of administering the society, the world, by following the ethical principles, religious prescriptions. Here in the Bible, we find a norm about how the higher people before the lower people and the lower before higher people should behave, how a marriage should take place, how one should deliberate wisely in deciding of worldly affairs, how one can defend his fatherland, how one can defeat the enemy, how one can administer the state externally and internally. Along with treating the Bible like an ordinary manual for successful business, this passage surprises us with its surprising optimism. Those who keep the rules and prescriptions ordained by God and revealed literally in the Bible will prosper. What underlies this optimism is an idea of God's visible justice and government, visible in the sense that its principles are clearly given in a language accessible to human beings so that they may follow and calculate the result of their obedience and disobedience to them. An episode of Tanco, a cunning bell maker in De Carolo Magno on Charles the Great, by Notker the Stammerer, showcased this imagination of God's immediate government of the world. After delighting Charles the Great with the sound of his bell, this cunning bellmaker promised to cast a better bell if the king gives him a great weight of copper and silver. After receiving the metal he asked for, however, he makes a bell using only tin, hiding the silver he received from the king, and produced a bell that looks much better than earlier one. But for all the attempts by the warden of the church and others, the bell does not ring, as he demonstrates it finally to Charles the Great. The clavish bellmaker himself tried to make the bell ring. That brazen mass suddenly falls on the head of the cheetah, passing straight through his carcass and kills him. What is glittering through between the lines of this episode is a conviction that divine justice will react to good and bad behavior with reward and punishment immediately. In this context of optimism, the accident, the sudden fall of the metal, the happening that was not expected or could not be expected because of their impossibility or improbability, follows a principle of reward and punishment according to the merit of each behavior. It was believed that God also revealed the principle of his government in a symbolic language along with the Ten Commandments. In the context of the theological idea of epiphany, the order and regularities found in the world, in the universe, in the movements of the planet, in the changes of the four seasons, and the alternation of day and night, all these things were interpreted as reflecting God's reason and hiding his secret of creation. The whole world is, in a sense, a book to be read, interpreted by human beings. Alain of Lille, a 20th century writer, wrote, all the world creatures all the world creatures, the second passage, all the world creatures as a book and as a picture are to us as a mirror, and that our life, our death, our present condition, and our passing are faithfully signified. If you are reader of the book Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, you must have read this passage at the beginning where William of Baskerville is writing to the monastery. It's actually this part is from Ellen of Rille. I continue. Hugo of St. Victor declared in his Didascalicon that all human creation should imitate nature. The clothes of human creation imitate the principles of organization and function. Organism function incorporated in a relevant natural object, the closer it will approximate perfection. It doesn't have to be surprising that medieval political writers long believed that an ideal state must imitate the natural order, hoping that a state could become less defective and more resistant to the changes and vagaries sweeping the human world when it adopts God's government of the universe. John of Salisbury wrote in his Polycraticus, the first major work dedicated to the copy of government and the proper behavior of princes in the Middle Ages. We must follow nature, the best guide of living. From him onwards to the later Middle Ages and even in the Enlightenment, numerous authors of medieval princes repeatedly present monarchy as the best form of government, citing the example of the heaven where the sun resided of other planets in the middle, or the kingdom of the bees where a queen bee is surrounded by other bees. An optimistic view and rationalist expectation that by adopting a certain set of recognized rules and principles, one could keep a grip on the circumstances comes to the fore here again. And it's them. So this is probably a visual representation of this idea. You see here, for instance, the halo surrounding the God's head is in proportion to the sphere surrounding the earth. So there's five different colors signify five different elements that compose the world, the universe. And also, he is holding a compass, which signifies actually the God's rays may be compared to some geographical rules. And according to these geographical principles, the whole world created. If you look at the eyes of the God, it's exactly looking at the center of this unit. That is, the world incorporates God's rays and God's creating principle most prominently among all the creatures. And this eye incorporates the whole world is constructed, it's moving, administered by God's reason, which is very possible, even accessible to human reason. This picture may be a representative case of the optimistic, rationalistic idea of the High Middle Ages. I'm representing here actually an opinion opposed to what is usually believed about High Middle Ages, because usually people say High Middle Ages are ages of superstition, all sorts of miracles, all sorts of wonderful ideas believed at that time. And this darkness was driven out with the Enlightenment, but I must say actually, at least this idea, this proverb, this optimism was quite predominant in the 12th century. And then a story follows how this optimism slowly declined and replaced finally by the sort of pessimism or cynicism, cynical idea, which I described at the example of Martin Luther's Niccolo Machiavelli. The pinnacle of this rationalism, optimism, was reached in the legal theory of the High Middle Ages. On the basis of traditional Roman laws, Thomas Aquinas introduced a hierarchical system of laws in his Summa Theologiae, categorizing the laws in six divisions: eternal law, lex aeterna; natural law, lex naturalis; human law, lex humana; divine law, lex divina; laws of nation, jus gentium; civil law, jus civilum. For Thomas, natural law encompasses both the regulation found in natural world and ethical principles to be observed in the society of human beings. It is a part of the subcategory of eternal law, which is God Himself. It represents God's reason and the most realized in the possible world. Thomas acknowledges that the natural law cannot be directly enforced in a real society on account of different differences of individual societies. The human affairs, operationes humanae, are subject to contingencies, contingentiae, and a necessity exists only in relation to the commonalities, but not to the individual properties. Consequently, the laws of individual society usually differ. But how much do the society differ from each other? What sort of modification of the natural law necessary? For Thomas, all laws which are codified and practiced in a society must conform to the prescriptions of natural law. And the very way Thomas relates the natural law to positive laws of individual societies show that, for Thomas, natural law is more than a compilation of abstract ethical principles. He explicated that natural law can be translated into positive laws in two ways, either logically or intuitively. Law of the nations are acquired logically. That is, individual legal codes are won via logical deduction from a principle of natural law. If the natural law forbids harming others, for instance, murder is also forbidden and must be thus enforced. For Thomas, thus, the laws of the nations is a virtual logical extension of natural law and common to all laws of individual nations. The variety of laws in the world can be explained mostly regarding the civil law, which, according to Thomas, is an intuitive adaptation of natural law. Even in the case of civil law, the variation cannot be enormous, however, because Thomas believes that natural law serves here as a form. It is Aristotelian philosophical language. Indeed, he does not deny the possibility that a society adopts a law which is hard to harmonize with natural law, but he stresses that such a law is not dissolution and replacement of natural law, but an addition of prescription. The human world that Thomas imagines is therefore an arena that, despite of all individualities, can be regulated by way of legal system that is like the extended natural law. There is little room for significant irregularities that demand that a regent should decide prudently, that is, arbitrate on the ground of his judgment. At this place, I would cite an author in order to show how a landscape of political discourse after around 200 years changed. The author is Aurelio Lippo Brandolini, an eminent Florentine humanist of late 14th century. In his work, De Comparazione dei Repubbliche et Regni, on the comparison of republic and kingship, he introduces an imaginative dialogue about the best form of government between Matthias Corvinus, a Hungarian king, and his son and prince, Johannes Hunyadi. In the dialogue, the young prince puts republican rule over the monarchy, saying that everything is better administered and governed by many than by one. After listening to his son, the monarch briefly asks, "Even heaven itself?" We already know the strategy of the king. His next step would be to demonstrate the superiority of monarchy by pointing out its correspondence to the monarchical order found in the natural order, natural world. But he is immediately stopped by his young son's following words. Let's leave heavenly things aside. Things so remote from us must have very different principles from our own. Let us speak of our own territorial affairs, which, being close to us, are most similar to us, and far more knowable to us besides. Let us then speak of these things, please, Father, and pass over heavenly things for now. The young prince in Brandolin's dialogue no longer believes that human affairs can be properly regulated by referring to the rational principle pervading the universe. A consciousness of the qualitative difference of the human world from the other parts of the universe expressed in this brief but determined rejection. It must be noticed that the rejection by Machiavelli of the authority of the ethical principles and the qualification by Luther of the authority of the Bible in political deliberation happened within one generation from Brandolin's dialogue. Here I do not intend to propose Brandolini as a new hero and a pioneer of modernity in the political discourse and the culture of the West. Rather, I want to point out the commonality among three authors. The optimistic rationalism of two centuries ago is significantly weakened, albeit not wholly lost, and its individual ideas topoi are refuted. What triggered and led this paradigmatic change of discourse and culture? In the following, I will attempt to give an answer to this question while concentrating on four figures of later medieval political thought: John of Paris, Ptolemy of Lucca, Marcellus Padua, and Bartolus of Sassofenato, and tracing the changing conception of all human world and politics in their works. Now, five pages left. As John of Salisbury wrote his tract, De Potestate Regiae Papali, on royal and papal power, the strife between Pope Boniface VIII and Philip the Fair of France reached its pinnacle. Initially inflamed on royal taxation of the clergy in France, the quarrel between the sly old Pope, who spared no effort to push the claim upon the power supremacy of the church, and the equally crafty king, who desired to strengthen the royal power basis at all costs, developed into a sweeping power struggle, which ended in the kidnapping and accusation of Boniface by Philip's henchmen in Anagni, 1303. In a combination of Boniface's earlier provocation of the secular powers and the letters' response, this quarrel unleashed a flood of pamphlets of tracts, the first political propaganda war which has ever been fought after the demise of antiquity. John's tract stands out among the works produced in the royalist camp for its erudition. John's point is that the spiritual and the secular belong to different areas. In the former, the Pope has to possess the highest authority, in the latter, the king. This dualism is based on a philosophical interpretation or misinterpretation of Thomist ontology, according to which people are identical in forma but different in materia. As far as forma is concerned, that is regarding the need for eternal salvation, it is desirable for them to be ruled by one leader, the Pope. But concerning materia, that is regarding satisfying the bodily needs, it is impossible to subject them to one ruler. Instead, they have to be divided into different communities according to the same geographical ethnic backgrounds and customs and traditions. John represented this view especially regarding a question of whether there must be a universal monarchy. At the time, Boniface's attempt to win the support of a German emperor and the French throne had enough reason to be beware of its potential danger. John wrote, "But not all believers must integrate in that mode into one political community, but there must be maybe different life forms in the political community on account of geographical location, language, and other conditions of life. What is good for one people is not good for another. What is excessive to one may be short for another." John's argument radicalized the differences consisting among political communities so that No idea of unifying them into a political community can stand any longer. The view of the world underlying this idea contradicts that of Thomas Aquinas, where, as we have observed, almost all legal codes can be systematically derived from natural law, and there remains little room for differences among individual legal systems, among different communities. What essentially constitutes the French people, friend is French, are so many specificities only they share, What essentially constitutes the French people as independent, autonomous nation are so many specificities only they share, so that the knowledge of general legal prescription and the logical inductions from them are far short of ruling them properly. It is in this particularistic worldview that universality is nothing but an abstract principle, which is too abstract to give any practical help. John's case demonstrates how the rise of territorial state fostered particularism in worldview, and insofar may be understood to support the old thesis that a rise of a national state eroded the universalist culture of the Middle Ages, ushering into secularization. But the thought of Ptolemy of Lucca and Marcellus of Padua to be discussed successively will show that this is exactly not the case. Ptolemy, a Dominican monk, is known for his continuation of the regimine principum ad regem Cypri on the government of rulers to the king of Cyprus, as well as his determinatio compendiosa, a short determination jurisdiction for Roman Empire, where he represented a headstrong papalism that an election of an emperor acquires its validity only by approval of the Pope. In his continuation, Ptolemy represented the position that prepared republican collective rule to the monarchy. He divides all constitutions into two Aristotelian categories, political rule and legal rule. According to him, political rule is a rule through consultation and direction. It is an adequate form of government for people who are wise and virtuous, can be governed according to statutes, as the Italian city communes and the ancient Roman Republic exemplify. In contrast, legal government is repressive and exploitative. It is not different from despotic rule, which signifies rule held over slaves. Some people need the severity and harshness of this rule because they are by nature so corrupt and defective that they are not capable of living together without coercion. His glorification of self-rule and collective decision-making process by virtuous citizens in a free community of equals has been repeatedly quoted as the most visible case that demonstrates the influence of Aristotelian political philosophy, which had been reintroduced a generation before, and as an ideological reflection and elaboration of the experiences of republican communes in northern and central Italy. But I recently demonstrate this is not the case. Ptolemy wrote his work at the summit of a power struggle between Boniface and Philip the Fair. I have already explained about this struggle. And he always defended the Pope's supreme power over secular rulers. In this and other previous similar controversies between the papacy and the powerful monarchs of Germany and France, many cities of northern and middle Italy took the side of the church, claiming to be the defender of the liberty of the communes and the church. Ptolemy's appraisal of an uncorrupted nature sounds more as a love for liberty in the cities reflect this political and ideological situation. At the same token, the resistance by secular monarchs must have brought the idea of defectiveness of the monarchy and the need to subordinate the monarch to the church's leadership home to Ptolemy. What interests us is an innovation Ptolemy makes in the discourse on the ideal government while sustaining his argument, substantiating his argument. His preference for political rule contradicts the common sense of the Middle Ages that the entire universe is ruled by one and the same divine principle monarchy, and that human government also must adopt it in order to approach the perfection as far as possible. Ptolemy himself was aware of this and felt the need to justify his bold step. Commenting on political rule, he argues that the rector of the city is bound by the constitution, and that therefore his prudence is not free. Then the following remarks follows. Therefore, it is more remote from the divine and imitates it less. Although laws originate in natural law, and the natural law derives from divine law, nevertheless they fail in particular acts for which legislators cannot provide, since they are ignorant of future events. Ptolemy attempts here to defend his contradiction of a traditional wisdom by referring to the theory of expediency, but it cannot be convincing. The medieval notion of expediency was contrived to justify adopting an unusual measure in view of an exceptional situation, but he himself does not view political rule as such an emergency measure. It is one of the normal forms of government, even a superior one. Ptolemy's idea separates the government of human world from the government of other parts of the universe where divine reason is immediately visible. For him, the human world is so perverse and corrupt that its regulation requires different judgmental rules. Where divine and natural principles cannot have absolute authority, we need to take recourse to another form of reason, maybe reason specified to preserving the political community, which later came to be called the reason of the state. Ptolemy's case demonstrates that a secularization of political discourse was also provided, ironically enough, by the Church, which claimed the universality and the otherworldliness of its power. Marsilius of Padua, the third author to be discussed, has the same problem. On account of the time problem, I cannot discuss this interesting author extensively. Marsilius, a medical doctor from Padua, if we believe Alberto Musato's report, and the rector of the University of Paris, belonged to the circle of intellectuals around Ludwig IV of Bavaria, who had a long-lasting quarrel over his imperial title with Pope Johannes XXII. Although it is unclear whether his major work, Defensor Pacis, Defender of Peace, on the publication of which he had to flee from Paris to Munich, was written in view of defending Ludwig's cause in dispute, its contention supports such reading in many places. Marsilius has fascinated many researchers for his argument that seemed to represent the principle of people's sovereignty and democracy. According to him, the degeneration of morals after the fall finally made it necessary for people to have a government in order to keep peace among themselves. The rule falls on the shoulder of legislators, who are the whole body of citizens or its prominent part. Tibium Universitas aut eius pas valentior. According to him, this rule by many is preferable to rule by one, because many eyes can find out problems and faults better than two, and many will keep the rule better when they themselves are the legislators. In the process of legislation, the religious and ethical rules should be kept in view, but Marsilius contends they do not have a self-evident authority and bind the legislators. I leave the question untouched whether Marsilius' theory should be approached in terms of development constitutionalism and the theory of people's sovereignty and democracy. or the 14th century imperialist ideology. I only mention that the imperial throne has long been understood as an electoral monarchy, and that the idea of rule on the ground of consent of the body of citizens or its prominent part may signify several different political procedures in the later medieval context. At any rate, Marsilius, with his theorist government, was confronted with similar problems which preoccupied the Ptolemy's mind, namely how to justify the discrepancy between his vision of ideal human rule and the universal principle of monarchy. The following passage demonstrates that Marsilius took a different strategy from Ptolemy. I read, cite, "In a single city or a single realm, there should be only one single principate, or if there are several in number or in species, then there should be among them one in number that is supreme of all, through which the rest are reduced, regulated, and any errors that arise in them corrected. Now it is only this principate, as seeing the supreme, that I say must necessarily be one in number and not several, if the realm or city is to be rightly ordered. And I say the same of that which exercises the function of prince. A prince that is one in number, not in respect of human subject, but in respect of office. For there is a type of supreme and well-tempered principate that is one in number, and where more than one man exercise the function of a prince, as in an aristocracy or in a polity. And because of the numerical unity of the action that issues from them in this way, the principate is said to be one in number, whether it is ruled by one man or several. Indeed, Marsilius confirms here rule by one as a universal principle government, but virtually hollows it out by allowing multiple interpretation of it. Now, rule by one may designate monarchy, aristocracy, rule by people, or whatever forms of government, insofar as it shows sufficient unity in decision implementation of it. It is only regarding the all-encompassing empire that Marsilius sticks to a traditional wisdom. Rule by one signifies literally rule by one decision maker. For Marsilius, thus, the universal practical rules like natural laws are hardly more than an abstract guideline which has to be subject to practical deliberation and interpretation, and may be variated both in content and form numerous ways, and to the extent that there is hardly any convergence possible between the guideline and the concrete final decision. It is inevitable that such a view would result in a dualist notion of a truth, an abstract truth and concrete practical truth. Exactly this is the case with Bartolo Sassoferrato, a jurist representing the post-glossatory Glossator school of the 14th century. Bartolo left a tract, the Regimina Civitatis, on the government of cities, along with his voluminous commentaries on Roman laws and other treatises. The tract is an important document that allows us to glimpse at a view of government prevalent in contemporary Italy, especially in the cities of northern and central Italy where he taught and worked. Especially significant is his discussion on the best form of government because it reflects on what he observed and experienced during his services. A reader who expects an ardent defense of republican rule in the pages of this small tract would soon feel disappointed, however. His view shows the strong influence of Aegidius Romanus or Jill of Rome, who represented the rigorous papalism and supported the monarchy as the best form of government at the time of a strife between Boniface and Philip. Bartolus repeats that the best form of government can be inferred from the general principle of government in the universe, which is the monarchy. Monarchy fosters, preserves unity better by providing citizens with a rallying point and facilitates effective decision-making process. So far as a general theory of government, which Bartolus elaborates in the earlier parts of the treatise. But soon after this remark, he raised the question of the best form of government afresh, just one page later. This time dividing the cities and countries into three different types according to the size of the population. His argument is quite interesting and surprising, partly anticipating Jean-Jacques Rousseau's view, which relates the size of population to a specific form of government. According to him, the monarchy is the best form only for a city with a large population, but the other two types of cities, namely a city with mid-sized population and a city with a minimal-sized population, may experience hardships by adopting the one-man rule. The mid-sized city can be ruled best by the aristocratic government, the minimal-sized city by popular rule. I introduce here only a part of this discussion concerning a minimal-sized city. Regarding people or population of a small size, I say that it is not appropriate to be ruled by a king. First, this is proven by literature, because if Rome was the smallest, it drove the kings out of their turn for their turn to tyranny. Second, this is evidenced by reason. By nature of the king, great enterprise always requires high taxes, but the income of a king of a small city cannot suffice such consumption. Therefore, a king takes away what belongs to people and becomes a tyrant. This is the reason why God did not love that people demanded a king. He also slashes on aristocrats as an option because the number of aristocrats is small in such a city. Either people do not love to obey the minority, or aristocrats may be easily thrown away by internal strife, the result of which would be bad rumors, revolts, and civil wars. The only possible form in such a city is people's rule, citation. People of small size will be ruled best by the multitude, and this rule is called people's rule. That this form of government is good is clear, because Rome grew well at the time, that is, as it was ruled by people. Readers wait in vain for Bartolus to reconcile his two contradictory statements that monarchy is the best form of government and that the best form of government differs depending on the size of the city. There was no unifying theory. There was no unifying truth. Conclusion. The problem of uncertainty inherent in the human world, and more exactly in the enterprise to administer human society, has always preoccupied political thinkers, but it turned up in radicalized form in late antiquity in the context of the Christian apology of God's justice. The conception of the world, the seculum, denoted the field of ephemerality and temporariness which human beings pass through in their itineraries to their true destination, eternal salvation. There is no full understanding of the vicissitude of life, the troubles of hardship. Only God's grace can provide help, but it is also unknown to humans how to reach that help. The political discourse and culture of the early and high Middle Ages did not duplicate this pessimistic view. Rather, their view was optimistic, emphasizing the possibility of administering and reforming the world. They viewed the world as dominated by a visible principle of order, which together with God's revelation in the Bible would help them with their enterprises. The dissolution of this optimistic rationalist view since the early 14th century opened the way to the secularization of political discourse and culture of the West. The process was a complex one, not reducible to certain socio-economic changes by influences of a certain philosophical theological school. The later Middle Ages witnessed an endemic power struggles among all powerful political actors, from the papacy to city-states. The secular and spiritual powers clashed over power supremacy, the territorial rulers, the city republics, and imperial power were involved in prolonged struggle over the question of sovereignty and authority and autonomy. The ideologies of each camp brought a significant innovation into a way of understanding politics, rejecting and reinterpreting the traditional tenets. Secularization of political discourse and culture, one of the most important moments to shape modern Europe, slowly rose to the horizon of history this way. Thank you very much.